The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Callie White. She joins us on the telephone out in Iowa. Hello, Callie.
Hi, Vic. Thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. And you're in central Iowa.
I am. I'm okay. Just right outside Des Moines, so just right about the middle of the state.
Okay. And the new book is called The Monsters We Make, and I know how you got the idea, but I'm sure our listeners don't. Tell them how you got the idea for this story.
This is my third novel, and it's loosely based on the real, still unsolved Des Moines paperboy abductions, which occurred in the early 1980s. And the novel explores the effects of the abductions on a group of residents in a local neighborhood. There's an 18-year-old girl. She's an aspiring journalist, and she's drawn to the stories of the missing boys. And she has a 12-year-old brother who is also a paperboy in the same neighborhood who's hiding a terrible secret of his own. And then there's a local cop who's been assigned to both of the abduction cases. And the book is really built on the idea of one crime inadvertently exposing another. And as I said, part of the story is loosely based on the disappearances of real paper boys in the Des Moines area. There was Johnny Gosch in 1982 from a West Des Moines neighborhood. Eugene Martin was in 1984, and he went missing from a South Des Moines neighborhood. And then there's a third lesser-known case of a boy named Mark Warren Allen in 1986. From the same Southside neighborhood as Eugene. And so I grew up in Iowa. I've grown up with these cases the majority of my life and started getting a story kind of brewing to build around the real cases. And that's kind of where it started, yeah.
I read your essay on the Crime Reads website. And
yes.
I had never heard of that third boy. That he wasn't a paper boy, though, was he?
He was not, and his case is has been fairly unknown because at the time when he went missing, his case wasn't really reported. It didn't really hit the news. I think for a few reasons, he wasn't a paper boy at the time, and his family, I think, was very reluctant to cooperate with the police. At the same time, his family has said that the police were also reluctant to go public with it because I think at that point they were really worried about just a citywide panic.
Well, this was a shocking case, and I'm sure some of our listeners who have been around for a while can remember back in the early 80s when the face of young Johnny Gosch appeared on milk cartons. And I believe he was the second missing youth to be pictured on milk cartons.
Johnny and Eugene were the very first faces on milk cartons. That originated here in Des Moines.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was Eton Potts that was number one and Johnny was number two. But
Eton came right after when the milk carton program went national. Yeah.
I see. Well, Johnny is really well known, and that was such a shock. And then 2 years later, when Eugene was also abducted or mysteriously disappeared, mm-hmm. that we'd become sort of deadened to it already, hadn't we?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. So when Johnny went missing in September of 1982, I was 7 years old at the time, and I lived 2 hours south of Des Moines. I grew up on a farm kind of near the Iowa-Missouri border.
Uh-huh.
I don't have real memories at the time when Johnny went missing. But when Eugene went missing in August of 1984, I was 9. And I happened to be in Des Moines on vacation with my family,
uh-huh.
which was kind of a rare trip for us to come to the capital city. We were, my parents were farmers, and we just didn't travel to the city very often. And we happened to be staying in a motel just a few blocks away from where Eugene went missing. And it was on my sister's 14th birthday when it happened. So I had this kind of coincidental close proximity to that case. And I think it, because of that, that's the case that really left a big impression on me and is the case that stuck out in my mind. And when I started researching the cases for the book, this would have been like 4 years ago, right around the 30th anniversary of Eugene's abduction, I started to realize that Eugene's case was a little bit of the watershed case, especially for Iowans, because when Johnny went missing in 82, the West Des Moines Police Department was really reticent to call it an abduction and to just outright say he was kidnapped. Mm-hmm. There was, I think Iowans really wanted to hang on to this idea that Iowa, Des Moines, these were really safe places to live, and things like this just didn't happen. And there was always this kind of lingering doubt that Johnny possibly ran away, that it was a truancy case, just a boy sort of acting up or something along that lines. Mm. But once Eugene went missing under nearly identical circumstances, Iowans just couldn't explain it away anymore. It was clear that both of these boys had been abducted and something much more nefarious was happening. Mm-hmm. So I always think of Eugene's case as sort of the case that was a reckoning for Iowans. We just couldn't ignore anymore that something really terrible had happened. Yeah.
No more Iowa nice. So you were 7 years old. You were in Des Moines on a rare visit. And if it was August of 1984, let me take a wild guess, you were there for the Iowa State Fair.
It was just getting ready to start the following week.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And if your family were farmers, was it so that you could show something at the fair? Did you have, were you part of the fair? Did you have some livestock or blueberry pies or something that you were showing off?
Well, my brother and I had been in 4-H
okay.
for many years. My brother showed animals. That year, neither of us had anything at the state fair.
Okay.
We had come. There's also an amusement park here in outside of Des Moines called Adventureland.
Uh-huh.
It's a common summer destination spot
sure.
for Central Iowans. So we had, I think, spent a day or two at Adventureland and I remember Ghostbusters was in the theater. We went to see that in the mm-hmm. theater and then had you know, other plans kind of in the area.
Okay.
But not specifically to show at the fair, no.
Okay, the way you set up your book, The Monsters We Make, your first paper boy is abducted in the same part of town as Johnny Gosch. It's mm-hmm. not the same day, but your second paper boy, also with a different name, is abducted on the south side of Des Moines, and it's exactly the same day that Eugene was kidnapped. Now, I know you're probably tiptoeing around the similarities between the real cases and the imaginary ones. Tell us where these diverged in your mind, because you take us to some very dark places in your story.
Yes. In early drafts of the novel, I had used the real cases. I used the real names of the boys. But as I was revising later drafts and I was working with my agent at the time, we started talking about the families, and there are still members of both Johnny, Eugene, and Mark's family who are still alive. And her concern was, you know, if we fictionalize this, we can give some distance to the surviving family members. But at the same time, you know, if you fictionalize them to some degree, you have a little more freedom in the storytelling. You're not quite so locked into facts and the exact timelines. So once I fictionalized the cases, I knew I would play around a little bit with fictionalizing certain parts, but there were some details, some real facts I wanted to keep in the book and honor, because these cases have had some historical significance when it comes to missing children cases and how these cases, how missing children cases are investigated now. Mm-hmm. So I was playing around with a mix of some fictionalized parts and some facts. I kept Eugene's date, the actual date he went missing, because that was the case that was so significant to my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to keep that date in there. And I kept Mark's date. He went missing on Easter weekend in 1986 in the evening while he was walking to a friend's house.
Okay.
And really the only major detail I changed about the fictionalized version of Johnny's case was the date, yeah.
Have you ever met Johnny's mother?
I have not met her.
Okay.
I have seen her around town. She's a yoga instructor in the Des Moines area, so mm-hmm. I've been in a few classes with her.
You have?
Over the years, yes. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to her son's case, she stopped doing public interviews several years ago.
Uh-huh.
I think the last interview she did was in 2014 for a documentary. And she was also speaking. This was when there were two missing girls in eastern Iowa, kind of in the Cedar Rapids, Cedar Falls area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was working with the parents of those two. It was two missing cousins. And part of the documentary was she was talking about those cases, working with those family members, and then also her experiences when her son went missing.
Okay.
But other than that, she does not do public interviews anymore. And Eugene's parents, they have all died several years ago. He had a lot of siblings, but they're all adults and have scattered. And
uh-huh.
So he really doesn't have a lot of surviving family around anymore. Yeah.
In case you're just tuning in, this is the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I've been joined on the telephone by Callie White. We're talking about her new novel, The Monsters We Make, and I'll continue my conversation with Callie right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling, and today we're listening to a storyteller named Callie White, and she's got a new book out called The Monsters We Make, and it's based on some real abductions that took place in Des Moines back in the early 80s. Let's talk about your story. Sammy Cox, he's really, I think, your main character in here. His sister, too, but Sammy, he's the one our hearts go out to. Can you tell us about Sammy? You build this character so beautifully, and I don't want to give anything away, but tell us who this kid is.
Yeah, thank you. Sammy was a character that developed a little bit later in the writing process of this book. I had started with the character of Crystal as sort of, and I kind of thought of her as a little bit of the moral compass of the overall story.
Mm.
And in early drafts, Sammy was a little more of a background character to a certain degree. But as I kept writing, he kept coming up more and more, and his story kept developing to a darker place, as you said in an earlier comment.
Mm-hmm.
And I reached a point where I was writing a certain scene that occurs kind of in the first maybe quarter of the book, and I realized, I think this is going where I think it's going, and I either have to embrace it or I need to change it. And I decided this is Sammy's story, and this is the story he's trying to tell, as difficult and dark as it is. And I need to just embrace it and go for it.
Mm.
And so that's kind of, once I made that agreement, I went with it. And I tried to write Sammy as sensitively as I possibly could. I wasn't interested in showing gratuitous details of what was happening to him, but yet I wanted to be as truthful about what he was going through as possible.
Mm. Clearly, since these are unsolved cases, the real cases, we can only speculate as to what might have happened to these young boys and why. And, of course, the suspicion is that they were abducted by pedophiles. And there's a lot of that material in your story as far as what pedophiles are and who they target. Do you want to talk at all about that?
Yeah. So at one point, I tracked down and interviewed one of the original investigators on the Eugene Martin case. He's a retired officer named Jim Rowley. And he was very open and gracious with sharing his experiences on that case. He also worked a little bit on the Mark Allen case. And one thing that struck me in talking to Jim was how much those cases haunted him, Eugene's in particular. It was one of the only unsolved cases, I think, from his career by the time he retired, and just really haunted him. He'd gotten to be good friends with Eugene's father and met with him for many years every week to talk about any leads or, you know, any tips that Eugene's father had come across. And it was through my interview with Jim that I started to realize that these cases are most often, the perpetrators behind them are most often just people in our neighborhood, people in our communities. When we sometimes talk about criminals who've done horrible things, like horrendous abuse cases or murder cases, abductions, things like that, we sometimes talk about them in terms of like they're monsters, they're evil, they're almost Satan-like, which that is how they feel to us. But at the same time, that isn't how they look. That isn't actually how they move in our community. They move and look like regular people. You know, they're often just our neighbors, our car mechanics, they're dentists, they can be anyone and do anything, any type of occupation. And I think sometimes our language around them can in some ways camouflage them a little bit and help them hide in plain sight because they don't look any different. The truth is they look like everyone else. And so that's sort of a big theme I was exploring through these cases, that sometimes the big, high-profile, newsworthy cases like the Paperboy cases hide the fact that while stranger abductions did occur, they were actually a very, very small percentage of missing children at that time and even now. The vast majority of abuse cases are children who are being abused by somebody they know, a family friend, a family member, someone they know through the community. And we kind of forget, or they get a little overshadowed in that sense. And so I was exploring that part of it. Fictional characters, yeah.
Yeah. The pedophiles can blend right in. And yeah. Another thing that I noted in this story and thought about, particularly in light of what's going on in our world lately, is that 20 years ago, I had Tyari Jones on the program for her first novel, and it was based upon a number of abductions that took place in Atlanta, and they didn't really get much attention, and it's possibly because all of these young people were black. And then suddenly we get these young middle-class white boys from Des Moines who are abducted, and suddenly the whole world's paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sad thing, but that's the reality.
It's so true. I've read that book, Leaving Atlanta.
Yep, that's it.
And I actually heard Tiari speak at a writer's conference. She read some pages from that book. It's a fabulous book.
Mm-hmm.
And that fact was at the back of my mind. There's a short line in the book where Crystal is talking to a friend of hers about these cases. Her friend's name is Somphone, and she mentions to Crystal, well, you know, there's all those missing kids in Atlanta, and Crystal sort of has this moment where she's like, what missing kids? I don't even know what you're talking about, what missing kids in Atlanta. And Somphone explains a little bit about the cases, and Crystal sort of has this reaction like, why haven't I ever heard about them? And Sansone says, well, because they're black. And it occurs to Crystal almost in an embarrassing way, like, ah, I get it, say no more. Mm-hmm. And it's just a very brief moment in the book, but I felt like it was important to acknowledge that while my book is focused on the three cases of these, particularly the two missing paper boys who were white, young white boys, that there were plenty of other cases that didn't get that level of attention and national news coverage for that very reason.
Yeah. I've seen some of the press material has compared you to Renee Denfeld, who I've had on the program several times, and I can see why they compare you to her. She's a brilliant writer, too.
Thank you. I'm a huge fan of Renee, so I always appreciate any comparison with her. I loved The Child Finder. I thought that was such a well-done book.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Your brother and sister, Sammy and Crystal, they have something in common in that they're both sort of outcasts. Sammy is kind of overweight, and he's sort of shunned by his classmates. And Crystal has her own issues, and we really relate to them because they're outsiders.
When the characters first started kind of coming together in my mind, Crystal, I think, came first. And of all my fictional characters that I've written in all my books, I think Crystal may have the most pieces of my younger self in her, in that she's, at a young age, as a teenager, she really feels like she has something to prove because she has felt a little bit like she's always on the outside and she's a little bit of an underdog, maybe. Mm-hmm. And Sammy ended up evolving into a little bit of an outsider himself in a different type of way. I think his sense of feeling like an outsider grows from what's happening to him, that he's going through this secret trauma that he just can't tell anyone about, and carrying that kind of terrible secret takes such a toll on him and makes him feel isolated and different from everyone else. So they do have these sort of outsider senses to them in different ways, for sure.
And Crystal, despite the involvement of a police officer who is investigating this disappearance, who by a quirk of fate was also on the same force in West Des Moines that investigated the first disappearance, he's transferred to another department, and here he's stuck with investigating the second disappearance. He is the sleuth, supposedly, who's investigating this, but it's really Crystal. Crystal's the one doing the legwork. She's the one that actually has a clue. And this poor police officer, Dale, he's deeply troubled. And I know you've read a lot of crime novels, because he's kind of a classic cop in a crime novel in that his marriage is a mess.
It is. Dale, I did start out sort of loosely basing Dale on Jim Rowley after interviewing him. But then as Dale evolved, he really started to take on a life of his own, as a fictional character should. And that was one of the liberties I took when I fictionalized the cases, that I was able to make him, having worked both cases in two different jurisdictions. That never actually happened. There were never any investigators in the Des Moines area who worked on both the West Des Moines and Des Moines case. But for the purposes of a fictional novel, it worked out much better. It just made a more interesting character to have him just having left West Des Moines and that unsolved case that had kind of haunted him. And he hasn't been in the Des Moines jurisdiction very long before it happens again. And he's also got some baggage from some things that happened in his own past. And it all together, I thought it made him a really charged character, someone who all these things collectively can push them in all the wrong ways. And I think that's ended up what ended up evolving with him, that it started to affect him personally, professionally. It just all sort of came to a head. Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to mention all of your main characters because I want readers to be able to discover them on their own. But I think that Dale is a beautifully conceived character, and I really like him as a character. And one other character I'd like to mention is their mother, Sam and Crystal's mother. She's another really great character, and we relate to her. And she's the one who kind of creates the situation for a pedophile to get involved. Not that she wants to, but this poor woman is working all these jobs. She is having a hard time making ends meet. She's divorced. And this creates an opportunity for pedophiles.
Yes. I spent some time studying FBI profiles of pedophilia, and sort of, which sounds like a terrible way to spend your time. And in a way, it kind of is. It's really stomach-turning stuff to read about. However, I knew if I was going to write about it, I needed to really understand it. And when I got into the profiles, there was a lot of information on sort of how pedophiles can choose and groom families, and often families who need help, who are, like single mothers, kids who are struggling or need a little bit of extra attention. It's not that I think these mothers are negligent or that they're bad parents. Quite the contrary. I think they are good parents, and they're looking for extra support for their kids, and they're welcoming some positive influences in their lives. And that's kind of the MO of a pedophile. They're offering precisely that, and they're doing and saying all the right things. And in the case of the character of Tina, she's doing the best she can. I think that was the basis I kept writing her from, even when it seems like she's not always doing or saying all the right things. She really is, at the end of the day, doing the best she can. And that was always the guidelines I used to write her. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In case you're just tuning in, my guest is Callie White. We're talking about her new novel, The Monsters We Make. She joins us on the telephone in Iowa. And I'll continue my conversation with Callie right after this. It's the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Callie White, her new novel, The Monsters We Make. Callie, this was a very compelling read for me and a deeply personal read because I'm from Des Moines. And I can remember.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, we did talk about this a little bit on email.
Yeah,
yes.
I grew up in Des Moines. And in 1982, I was managing a record store in Des Moines, and I remember hearing about Johnny Gosch. And it just hit me like one of those central Iowa tornadoes because I had been a paper boy, and I was very familiar with what paper boys do. Back before these paper boys were getting abducted, we had 12-year-old kids out there in the early hours of the morning walking along, and that has all changed. You don't have those youthful paper carriers anymore because of these abductions. Now adults deliver the papers.
Yes.
And I can remember, as I read your book, you actually mentioned the street where I used to pick up my bundle.
Oh.
And I delivered the Des Moines Tribune, the afternoon paper, which
they stopped
making it in 1982. I worked for the old Register and Tribune when it was owned by Kohl's before they sold it to Gannett.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been carrying from fourth grade to the eighth grade. So I started delivering the paper when I was 12, and you delivered the afternoon paper 6 days a week, and then on Sunday morning, we delivered the Morning Register, the big paper.
Mm-hmm.
And my older brother, he got a route in sixth grade, and so when I was in the fourth grade, I would go out with him on Sunday mornings and help him deliver. So we'd be out there together, and he kind of taught me the ropes. He said, okay, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and the bars closed an hour ago on Saturday night in Des Moines, And if you see a car go by really slowly, he said, hide. Hide,
isn't that amazing?
Hide in the bushes. He said, if you're out on your corner, getting your bundle, he said, you see a car go by slowly, if it's not a cop car or a yellow cab, he said, hide.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and he knew that, and so he taught me that. And so when I got my own route, my best friend lived two doors down, and he had a route too, and we go out together, and we deliver each other's routes together. So we always had somebody with us. And I used to pick up my bundle right at the corner of 42nd and Ingersoll. You mentioned Ingersoll in your book.
I know right where that's at.
Yep.
Yes.
And on my Sunday bundle, I would pick up at the corner of 43rd and Grand. My my route was Grand Avenue, clear down to Greenwood Park, and I also did 42nd Street on both sides. And my buddy, he delivered south of Grand. He had those big mansions down there.
Oh, yeah, and that's a hilly area, too.
Yeah. And the thing that I thought of, which you don't hear talked about too much, was we used to have to go out every 2 weeks at night and collect. We would go door to door to our customers, and we would show up, and it was $1.30 for 2 weeks. And we'd knock on their door, and every 2 weeks we had to go around in the evening after dinner and collect. So we were out there exposed to whatever, little kids walking around, and we didn't think anything of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you also mentioned in your book, Beggar's Night. And I didn't realize until I left Iowa how unique Beggar's Night was in Des Moines.
I didn't either until I became an adult. And other, like, transplants, people who move into Iowa were so confused by, what is this Beggar's Night? I've never even heard of it.
And the yeah. thing is, you had to do a trick to get a treat.
Yes.
And that was a Des Moines thing. And I didn't realize that until I came out here, and kids would come to the door and I'd say, okay, what's your trick? And they'd look at me like, huh?
So confused.
They didn't get it.
So it's so interesting to think, you know, as a farm kid, I never, like delivering papers, that was never even something anyone I knew had an option to do. And I was able to interview a few now adults who delivered in the Des Moines area, delivered papers. And they described precisely what you did, that, you know, prior to the abductions, they were out at three and four in the morning. It would be pitch dark, getting their bundles rolling, that they often had to go, like you said, every other week to collect payments, and which today seems unthinkable.
Uh-huh.
You know, I grew up post abduction era. I was an adolescent during the height of the sort of panic in the 80s into the early 90s, and then by the time I became an adult and a parent myself, parenting had completely changed. So my era of parenting, my generation of parents, we are just very paranoid, very vigilant. Because of those cases, they just changed everyone's behavior. And like you said, paper boys, that kids delivering papers, that was phased out. There are, you never see children delivering papers anymore.
And that all started with the abduction of Johnny Gosch. And Noreen Gosch, Johnny's mother, was so prominent and has remained prominent as sort of a figurehead for abducted children, and she's just haunted me all these years. And in the late 80s, I had a client in a big office building out in West Des Moines, and I remember getting on the elevator one time, and there was a woman on the elevator with me, and we were alone on the elevator, and I looked at her, and I realized it was Noreen Gosch.
Yeah.
And she, I think she worked at a law firm in that building, and she had the most haunting eyes. She didn't say a word to me. She just looked at me. And initially, for years, I thought, now, is she looking at me thinking about, I wonder what my son looks like now, if he's still alive. Mm-hmm. And then, after reading your book, I thought, I wonder if she's looking at me like, is this the pedophile that abducted my son?
Yeah, I bet it's both. I bet she experiences both, and she probably will until the day she dies.
Well, I'm guessing that you were kind of tiptoeing around her, because I know she's very aware. Anytime Johnny's name is mentioned, a number of years ago, I reviewed a book for the Dayton Daily News, and it was a book based on an abducted paperboy story. And so when I wrote the review, I mentioned Johnny Gosch, and within 24 hours, I had an email from Noreen Gosch.
Wow.
She was right on it. And we exchanged a few emails.
I did, tiptoeing is a good word to describe it. I was trying to walk a fine line of bringing the historical significance of those cases to the story while not exploiting them, I guess, at the same time, or dishonoring or disrespecting their surviving family members, or even the boys themselves. I didn't want to make the real boys and the real cases almost like commodities, I guess. People, you know, we get so fascinated. I'm a true crime fan, and I think we can get so fascinated with the details and circumstances of real cases that we forget there are actual people behind them. There are real devastated people behind them. And at the end of the day, there were three boys who never came home. And their families never got answers. To this day, still don't have answers what happened to them. So I was tiptoeing, trying to walk a fine line between honoring the real historical significance of the cases while not exploiting them at the same time, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
I think you did an excellent job. And
thank you.
I think that it could have really been bizarre if you had talked more about the reality of what's happened. Because for one thing, Noreen Gosch, I don't know if she still claims this, but she claimed Johnny came to see her.
She has. That, yes, she has. She actually stated that in court during a I think it was involving that man from Nebraska who claimed that he was present when Johnny was abducted. He was caught up in the, I think it was the Omaha Bank scandal that occurred in the mid-80s. Yeah.
You mentioned that you're from southern Iowa originally. Where at? Ringgold County, maybe? Or?
I grew up in Davis County.
Okay.
Which is heavy.
Is that Bloomfield?
Bloomfield.
Uh-huh,
yes.
Sure.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, right outside Bloomfield.
Yeah, my mother's mother was from Ringgold County. Grew up on a farm.
Yeah.
And my mother's father grew up in western Iowa on a farm. So I relate. I connect. Are you
know
still
Iowa well?
Yeah. Are you still living on a farm? You're outside of Des Moines.
I don't. I live the town I live in. It's really a bedroom community of Des Moines. The Des Moines area is it's very metro.
It's sprawled quite a bit, hasn't it?
It's a smallish town, but. No, I don't farm. My husband doesn't farm. He's a computer programmer. So.
Oh, okay.
And my parents are retired now and sold the dairy farm a few years ago. Yeah.
Nice. Well, my grandfather apparently was very fond of their milk cows, and this would have been about 1910. Because after he died, he was a World War I veteran, and after he died, my mother said, Amos wanted you to have these. These were his most treasured possessions, and they were a half dozen old rusty cowbells.
Oh, wow. After my parents retired, I think 40 years of living and working on a dairy, they were tired, and they were ready to rest and lead a less grueling lifestyle, I think. I miss the farm still to this day, but I don't have a romanticized memory of what it was like to live on a dairy farm and how hard the work was. And plus, you know, I was a child during the terrible 80s farm crisis. I vividly remember how uncertain and what a hard time that was for ag and farmers everywhere, and I don't really have much of a romanticized version of farming.
I can imagine. Yeah. How did you become a writer, Kelly? Tell us about your day job. What do you do besides write?
Well, I also am a creative writing professor.
Uh-huh.
So I teach for an MFA program called Linden. It's at Lindenwood University, which is actually based outside of St. Louis, Missouri.
Mm.
But the program is hybrid, so they offer half options for students to take online. So I teach I teach all my classes online. And
nice.
I've been there for over 4 years now, which is, I split my time. I usually write in the morning and teach in the afternoons. Prior to that, before I really got into writing seriously about 20 years ago, I was a social worker for the county I lived in.
Oh.
That's what my undergrad degree was in.
I see.
And I worked with, at the time, I worked with mentally disabled and physically disabled adults and children. So I have my bachelor's is in social work psychology, which is interesting because I feel like I still use that background every day in my writing when I'm creating characters or putting stories together and digging deep into the psychology behind why people do what they do. But I did leave that field almost 20 years ago and started writing full-time. And then almost 10 years ago after I got my master's, then I got into teaching creative writing part-time, yeah.
This pandemic hasn't really impacted you too much then since you were already teaching online.
It didn't change my work schedule at all because my students, my classes, everything were already online.
How nice. You mentioned that you're a true crime person.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have some podcasts that you like? Do you have some authors that you like? Can you tell us what you're into?
I'm a big fan. So I think British writers do true crime and crime stories really well. I read The Guest List by Lucy Foley recently.
Uh-huh.
I like Ruth Ware. There's an Irish writer, Tana French.
We've had her on the show. She's fabulous.
Oh, she's excellent.
Uh-huh. Psychological thrillers.
Psychological. She really mm-hmm. does that so well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of, we already mentioned Renee Denfeld, and I like true crime documentaries just as much as reading. I have a strange fascination with Keith Morrison on Dateline, which I'm a little embarrassed to admit, but I do. I think sort of how he presents true crime stories is endlessly fascinating. And I like a lot of the longer, more in-depth documentaries like they've done on Netflix, The Staircase, which profiled the Michael Connelly. Is his last name Connelly? I think it's Michael Connelly. His wife was the woman who was found dead at the bottom of the stairs, and he was tried I don't know how many times.
Hmm.
I like those types of deep dive documentaries. And I think my interest in true crime is less about the gratuitous violence itself. That's not really what interests me. I find that crimes often reflect something about a society or community at that time.
Mm.
And I think that's what I find so endlessly fascinating. It's like a commentary. The Paperboy cases were that way. They were a snapshot of an era that doesn't exist anymore. And I think about like that heartbreaking crime in Colorado, the Watts case where Chris Watts murdered his wife and his two young daughters. And that case, I thought, was the thing I found so interesting about that case was the social media aspect of it. You know, how much of their lives had been documented on social media and looked one way. They looked like such a perfect, happy, loving family. And to then have this happen, that complete and utter contrast, I find so psychologically interesting. Mm. And I think that's what draws me to true crime so much, is what crimes often say about our society, our communities, and even ourselves at a certain time.
Yes. My guest is Callie White. We've been talking about her new novel, The Monsters We Make. And a number of years ago, I had the late Anne Rule on the program, the queen of true crime. And
I bet that was a fun interview.
Well, she mentioned how at one point one of her coworkers was a guy named Ted Bundy.
Right.
Same guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
You never know.
Unreal.
Who's in the cubicle next to you? I'm not trying to make people paranoid here, but you never
Unreal.
Know.
Mm-hmm.
As they used to say on the Shadow Radio Show, the evil that lurks in the hearts of men, you don't know.
You don't know. So true.
Yeah. Are you working on another book? Is there something in the pipeline? Are you thinking of ideas? What are you up to?
I am. I have oddly spent this whole summer writing mostly nonfiction, leading up to the release of the book in August. I started writing true crime profiles for the A&E Network. They have a blog on their website called Real Crime. So I've been writing true crime profiles for them all summer. I wrote about the Paper Boys. I wrote about another case here in Iowa about a missing news anchor named Jody Huzentrout. So I regularly write those profiles, and in the meantime, I have started a new novel. It's another domestic crime novel. This one is also loosely based on a case here in Iowa that had a lot of attention. It was a murder case that had a mental health thread in it, and which is why I got so interested in it and started following it so closely, because mental health and mental health care really became a huge part of my life a few years ago when this would have been in April of 2017, my longtime neighbors across the street, this was a husband, a wife, and their 24-year-old daughter, they were tragically murdered by their 21-year-old son and brother, who was severely mentally ill. His illness was grossly undertreated. He has schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and had a psychotic break and tragically killed his family one night. And because we were literally right across the street from them, knew the family for many years, all four of them, and as I learned more about their son's struggle with this mental illness and to get adequate help here in Iowa, we've had a pretty derelict mental health care system for several years now, I really became interested in that mental health thread. And so the two stories kind of came together in this new novel. It's probably the most passionate subject matter I've worked on to date, because it's been so personal, and I've had an unfortunate front row view of it. So that's the project I have in progress right now.
Well, we'll look for that whenever it comes out the other end of the pipe. And I'll look forward to hopefully to talking to you again.
Yes, that would be wonderful.
Well, it's really been a pleasure having you on the program, Callie. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vic. This was a delightful conversation.
Excellent. Well, that's the kind we like. My guest has been Callie White, and her new one is The Monsters We Make. You heard about it on the Book Nook on WYSO, produced right here in Yellow Springs, Ohio, for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.